emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy. It's where police are dressed in military gear here. And they crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And as long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
One year has passed since the fatal shooting of a British black man by a London Metropolitan Police officer, an incident which sparked a huge protest movement across the UK and demands for police reform amid widespread accusations of racism. 24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control, and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, one year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea Friday celebrated the 75th anniversary of its founding, with leader Kim Jong-un and his daughter observing a large military parade and fireworks in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square. On this occasion, the parade did not include missiles or large weapons. However, analysts suggest such events, which have taken place frequently in recent years, send a message.
These great parades and celebrations in North Korea serve both domestic and international purposes. They show the rest of the world that this regime is standing up to South Korea and to the United States and to Japan, and that it's ready to fire nuclear warheads if they attack North Korea.
Delegations from the DPRK's traditional allies, China and Russia, traveled to Pyongyang for the occasion, demonstrating stronger ties amid a shift toward more difficult relations with South Korea. The past year and a half have been particularly tense on the Korean Peninsula. Coming to office in May of 2022, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol resumed large-scale joint military exercises with the United States, and North Korea conducted more missile tests than ever before. The celebrations in Pyongyang come following reports Russia may purchase artillery shells and other weapons from the DPRK. The U.S. earlier this week issued a stern warning.
Providing weapons to Russia for use on the battlefield to attack grain silos and the heating infrastructure of major cities as we head into winter, to try to conquer territory that belongs to another sovereign nation, this is not going to reflect well on North Korea, and they will pay a price for this in the international community.
Despite that warning from the U.S., multiple reports indicate DPRK leader Kim Jong-un will travel next week to Russia to again meet for talks with President Vladimir Putin. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sounds of bombs, explosions, airstrikes, and screams are the only sounds the children of Jenin refugee camp have been hearing for years. Today they are screaming and yelling, but this time out of joy and happiness. The Freedom Theater that is nestled in the Jenin refugee camp was established in 2006 as a center for artistic expression and creative activism. The theater aims to empower the local community, especially young Palestinian refugees, through performing arts. It has become a safe haven for children to heal, if only a little bit, from the unseen wounds they suffer from under Israeli occupation and the recent attacks on their camp.
The Israeli attacks, the Israeli invasion, make this place a very difficult place, a very violent place. And that's what we are fighting for, to have this safe space for children. We're fighting to make the children in the camp grow up as a normal children. They have to have normal time as a children. With this kind of reality, while the Israeli attacks all the time, they are scared. They're having problems to sleep in the night. The bombs, the violence in the street. So they don't grow as children.
Minors between ages of 14 and 15 come to the theater 2 days a week to attend drama workshops. The main aim is to tackle the fear and trauma children here are living through, especially after the latest Israeli military raid.
The Freedom Theater is my second home. I love to come here to learn and play, to take part in plays, to entertain other children after what we saw during the Israeli incursions that has left martyrs and destruction and prisoners.
The theater means everything to me. We can find a space to express ourselves after the hard circumstances we go through and after the latest raid. Here I can gather with my friends, we laugh and play and feel safe. The teachers here take us on journeys and we visit other Palestinian cities.
Younger children, however, are the most affected by the current situation, and the Freedom Theater continues to hold therapy workshops for such kids. The theater's experts and coordinators, who directly work with the children, say many of them are too traumatized to speak, and that's why they use art as a tool for expressing what they feel. They say art can convey what sometimes cannot be said.
During the recent raids on Jenin, the children were affected both direct and indirectly. We tried to give them a space just to play. Many of the children returned after the raids, suffering from shocks, worry, and fear. One of our goals is to let children express their feelings. We try to explain to them that there are different forms of resistance. Remaining in our land and learning at school is another form of resistance.
Last July, during the deadly military raid on the refugee camp, many were killed and wounded, and the theater and its vicinity were damaged. but it emerged from the ashes and immediately organized activities to cheer up the camp's children through drawing and singing. The Freedom Theater in Jenin Refugee Camp continues to provide some relief to the camp's children. This theater has survived miraculously despite difficult situations at the camp, Israeli occupation, and more recently airstrikes during the latest Israeli military operation in the camp. Mona Qandil occupied Jenin Refugee Camp.
The United States announced they are sending depleted uranium shells for tanks to Ukraine, even though they pose the risk of serious civilian health issues for generations. The use of such toxic shells by the United States in Fallujah, Iraq, is often blamed there for an increase in cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality. Depleted uranium shells now follow F-16 fighter jets, cluster munitions, tanks, and other escalatory measures which Washington had said they would refrain from using in the conflict.
Piles that much more of an atrocity on the atrocities that we're already committing, the atrocity of overthrowing the democratically elected leadership of Ukraine and forcing it into a 9-year race war. Is a horror that should have taught Americans long before this that their government does not care about Ukraine, does not care about Russia, and it's a hard pitch to say that they care about America either.
The toxic shells were announced during a surprise visit to Kiev by the United States Secretary of State, where he announced another $1 billion in funding.
The new security funding that we're announcing today will also be bolstered by the arrival of U.S. Abrams tanks this fall and by training for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in the United States, complementing training that is already underway in Europe. In the ongoing counteroffensive, progress has accelerated in the past few weeks. This new assistance will help sustain it and build further momentum.
So far, the U.S. has given some $80 billion to Ukraine, or an average of nearly $1 billion per week since the unrest increased in February 2022. All the Western military aid has so far failed to succeed. The Ukrainian counteroffensive has barely dented Russian defenses. Western tanks often smolder on the battlefield. U.S. leaders now admit the war will continue for years. The obvious Russian success has many questioning the alleged military supremacy of the United States and NATO.
I think that there's no way that the West can win this war, and we're not fighting it to win it. We're fighting it to wear Russia down, using Ukraine as our blunt instrument to wear Russia down, smashing our friends, our allies, into the brick wall in hopes of knocking a few bricks out. But the narrative that has been sold to, is being relentlessly sold to Americans, is that we're on the verge of winning.
Congress is currently negotiating a bill for another $20 billion in weapons, even as polls show 55% of Americans don't want more funding for Ukraine. The influx of money has led to such rampant allegations of bribery that it just forced the replacement of Ukraine's Minister of Defense. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Press TV Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Northern Ireland was the scene of a bloody conflict which took place for almost 30 years between Catholics and Protestants, or Nationalists and Unionists. Nationalists wanted Northern Ireland to be united with the rest of Ireland, and the Unionists wanted to remain a part of the UK. London sent British soldiers to Northern Ireland who would remain there for 40 years. 3,500 people were killed, and the conflict continued until the Good Friday Agreement was reached in 1998. Currently, a proposed legislation, if passed by Parliament, called the Legacy Bill, will no longer allow new investigations regarding that era called the Troubles. What does it all mean, and why does the UK want to stop these inquiries? Well, stay with us as we look at these questions and more on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests now to the program. Steve Bell, activist Stop the War Coalition out of the UK. and Steve Keen, economist and author out of Budapest. Thank you both for being with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with, we have two Steves tonight. So Steve Bell, we'll start off in the UK. Let's talk about the legacy of the Troubles. What would you say was learned from that period?
Well, overall, most of the Irish parties in general have been determined to sustain the peace process and to address the questions of legacy. The problem has been that the British government has been extremely unwilling to do that. The reason is clear. The British government during the Troubles was engaged in running operatives who were engaged in illegal activity, including assassinations and attacks, particularly upon nationalists. And consequently, they are determined to prevent any investigation into the actual role of British armed forces and allied security personnel during that period. So that previously an agreement was reached between the British government, the Irish government, and all the parties in Ireland, particularly in Northern Ireland, about how the legacy of the Troubles, and in particular the needs of the victims and the families of the victims, should be addressed. What this new bill does is overturn that agreement and simply impose a blanket immunity and, above all, an immunity for British allied forces in for their actions during the Troubles.
Well, Steve Keen, why do you think that this is happening now? Why does the British government, why did the British government want to overturn this now?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I'm not an expert on the Irish situation, but I'm certainly an observer of it. And my feeling is that this is still a continuation of colonialism by other means, because if you look at a comparable experience with the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa at the end of the apartheid period, there was a point where de Klerk and Mandela were jointly running the country, where there was one people, as divided as they might have been, came together to overcome and transcend the horrific past they'd had. And so in that sense, there was a shared feeling that there had to be both truth and reconciliation. And I think, again, I'm not an expert here, but I remember that also involved a similar pledge that nobody would be prosecuted. This, to me, sounds like Britain doesn't want to have its agents exposed. And that's why I think it's more of a colonial thing than it is a genuine attempt to overcome the Troubles. And every time I pass through Northern Ireland, you can still feel the tension there. And this whole idea that we've still got a colonial impact on the British behaviour, I think is extremely worrying.
Well, Steve Bell, let's talk about up until now, there have been inquiries that have taken place since the Good Friday Agreement. Let's talk about accomplishments that these hearings have made, if any, and also why it seems that they have been delayed many, many times or suspended. I mean, your overall thoughts on the inquiries up to now.
Yes, there have been some important developments. I mean, the most widely known is undoubtedly the inquiry around Bloody Sunday on in January 1972. 14 unarmed Irish protesters and 14 people were killed, 15 others were wounded as a result of actions of the paratroop regiment. Now, this was immediately addressed by the then Conservative government, introducing what was called the Witchery Tribunal. That reported in less than a couple of months and said essentially the problem was the activity of the organisers of a peaceful protest, not the soldiers. It took until 1998 before a further inquiry, the Savile inquiry, began a deeper investigation. After 12 years of work, the Savile inquiry revealed that Widgery had been completely discredited and that it was the soldiers had lied about their activity, and that the those who were died and were injured were basically without blame. Prime Minister Cameron then issued a formal apology to the families of the victims. Now, that's in 2010, but still no justice. As recently as the 25th of August this year, the Bloody Sunday families got an agreement in a ruling in Derry Court that evidence against the soldiers from other soldiers on the day was admissible. If this bill is sustained, then that is the end of it. There will never be actual justice for the Bloody Sunday family. So there has been progress, but exactly that is what this bill aims to do, to prevent a real examination and apportioning of blame about the role of British armed forces.
Well, Steve Keaton, why do you think it has taken so long? I mean, we look at, we're in 2023, and when this happened, I mean, what is going on in your perspective? Why has how was the British government able to get away with this for so long and really no one paying a price?
This seems to be a British trend. I mean, look at the Grenfell inquiry. Nothing has happened out of that tragedy years after it occurred. The British seem to basically think if you add time to any problem, that solves the problem. But what they're doing here is provoking the troubles yet again. And to me, it's just a level of political incompetence at the top of the British about everything, Brexit, and including Brexit and its impact upon the Irish situation in the very first instance. So if you add time, troubles go away. That seems to be the British line, and I think it's completely wrong. They're actually likely to provoke the troubles once more rather than have them fade away.
Well, Steve, in Coventry, you said that that none of the soldiers had been prosecuted. What about taking it even above that? Because whenever we see conflict or wars, maybe there are some individual soldiers who may or may not pay the price. But the ones who actually were on top, the prime minister, let us say, at that time, I mean, these individuals seem to always get away with it. So do you think that it would make a difference at this point with the soldiers being prosecuted? What would you like to see?
Well, the prosecution of the soldiers would provide justice to the families. I mean, let's be clear on this. That is what the families have been campaigning for. Since 1972, they've been campaigning for justice for their loved ones. I agree that the soldiers do not simply act on their own initiative, and that all of the counter-insurgency actions of the British government during this period bore the role of a colonial government, and elements of war crimes need to be accounted for, and the actions of British governments of the period have to be opened up. This is exactly what the British government doesn't want to do. It wants to continue to justify such covert and secret operations, which of course it's engaged in today in different parts of the world. The British government has managed to isolate itself almost absolutely. All the political parties in Ireland oppose this bill. The Irish government opposes it. The United States government opposes it. The United Nations Human Rights Council said in a ruling in December 22. This bill fails to comply with the state's obligations to investigate serious human right violations, and it denies truth and remedy for victims. So the EU has also condemned the bill. So this is entirely arrogant by the British government to refuse to listen to anyone outside its own advisers and to refuse to once again provide any form of justice to the Irish people.
Well, Steve Keane, the UK government says the bill is aimed at, quote, addressing the legacy of Northern Ireland, of the Northern Ireland Troubles, and to promote reconciliation. What are your thoughts about this explanation? They're saying that we need to move on. We will have people and they will come and confess if they have done anything, so we will get the history of what exactly happened. But we need to move on and we need to reconcile.
I think the basic thing is move on. Let's just trying to forget it. This is classic British spin bowling with very incompetent cricketers. So they want their own guilt to go away. The reason I compare it to the South African process is that people really did have their own personal guilt on the line, and the guilt of the security forces as well. And there was a genuine sense of atonement. So that was a successful case of reconciliation. The British want this to basically, let's forget we had a colonial past while we still maintain a colony.
Well, what do you think, Steve? Because members of the Irish Republican Party, Sinn Féin, say the only reason for the legislation is basically to hide the truth and to protect British state forces. I mean, why now, though? This is something, a legislation that, of course, could have been enacted years ago. Why now? Why 2023 are we seeing this? Your perspective.
In my view, the British society in general and the Conservative government in particular is facing a crisis in terms of after Brexit has isolated itself internationally, made itself more or less absolutely dependent upon the United States in foreign policy terms. And it has created an atmosphere inside British society whereby there is almost a siege mentality that the rest of the world doesn't understand us, and it's about time they did. This will pass, but nevertheless, that is where we are. And so we have a government completely ignoring all of its so-called allies, certainly ignoring every single Irish voice of substance, and pretending somehow that this is its expression of concern for Irish victims. And it isn't only Irish people. The victims of the Birmingham bombings in 1974, 21 people were killed, will be denied the opportunity to have an inquiry into the deaths of their loved ones by this bill. Equally, citizens of the Irish Republic who lost relatives, perhaps through cross-border action by British-aligned forces, they will not be able to investigate or have an investigation of what happened to their loved ones. This is entirely against any idea of a victim-centered resolution. Instead, this is covering up for the perpetrators.
Well, Steve Keane, can this legislation open up old wounds? I mean, how sensitive is this whole situation still? What's the possibility that will create actually more animosity between the two? I mean, how do you see it?
Certainly, it'll create more animosity. Whether that leads to a renewal of armed conflict and so on, I certainly can't say. I certainly hope not. But this is, you know, they're trying to throw a blanket over a problem to hide their own complicity, and what they're doing is throwing petrol on a fire rather than something to put out the flames. So it is just the self-centeredness of British decision making, which is one thing I've noticed ever since I've spent the last decade living and working in Britain. And I make the analogy, it seems to go back to 1066, when Norman the Conqueror came in and wiped out the Saxon ruling class and put his own people on top. And the attitude from the ruling class was always that the peasants were a different species. And that nature of decision-making still seems to permeate how Britain behaves today. There's just no willingness to admit any wrongdoing on the part of the British government. And that is going to alienate, it could actually alienate both the other sides together, strangely enough, and say, well, the last thing we need is Britain.
Well, Steve Bell, I want you, because a lot of people who are watching this right now were either not born or very young when all of this happened. Talk to us about how divided these areas are still today, which were the focal points of violence during the Troubles area. For example, in Belfast, do we still have division barriers, separate schools, housing? Give us an idea of the sensitivity that still takes place today and what's going on.
Well, there are still divisions, although we have had, I mean, let us not forget this, and this is above all the contribution of people in Ireland itself, both sides of the border. We have had 25 years of relative peace in comparison to the Troubles, and that is the achievement of both the nationalist and unionist community in the six counties and supported by Irish people throughout Ireland. There are, however, tensions, and one has to say that these tensions have been systematically played upon by British government for British government purposes. So that, for example, during the Theresa May government, concessions were made to unionism in order to sustain the Conservatives without reference to the fact that under the Good Friday Agreement, there has to be a parity of respect and that the nationalist community were not being accorded such respect. There are tensions that can be quite profound. I mean, there are still peace wars in Belfast. But nevertheless, in comparison to prior to the Good Friday Agreement, the Northern Ireland is existing in a state of peace. Now, this bill, in my opinion, will not see a return to the Troubles. But what it will do will be to inflict a terrible scar upon the families and relatives of the victims of the Troubles, a scar that will remain with them throughout their life or until this bill is repealed and a proper investigation of all the outstanding crimes that their families and relatives underwent is carried out, whether it's an investigation, an inquest, or criminal proceedings if necessary.
Steve Keane, your perspective, what needs to happen? Because this bill hasn't totally been passed, but it is very close. The effects, if it passed, the effects, and is there something that can be done actually to make sure that this legislation isn't enacted?
I don't think it can stop the British enacting the legislation. I think the only real chance of anything positive out of this is if the two sides of the Irish equation come together and say, we have to resolve this ourselves regardless of what the British do. Look, the British history has always been a case of taking a minority group and turning it against a majority and putting the minority in control. That was the Muslims versus the Hindus in India. It was the Igbo and the Igbo. There's so many times they've done this. And the Catholics and the Protestants in Ireland is another case of the same thing. The way that the Troubles was actually ended was by the nationalists and the unionists coming together and doing it themselves. And I think ultimately that's the only way to solve this problem. Don't let the British try to solve any problem for you. They're simply trying to disguise their own. Do the solution yourselves and tell the Irish where to get off. Tell the rather English where to get off.
Okay, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Steve Bell, activist Stop the War Coalition out of Coventry, UK, and Steve Keane, economist and author out of Budapest. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and another group right here in Tehran.
We here at RIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the divine ascension of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is a day of double grief. It is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners.
In the limelight.
Experts say France's abaya ban is clearly a distraction aimed at diverting attention of the broader French society from real problems at home. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, few political analysts will disagree that the events in Africa have resulted in France experiencing some serious foreign policy setbacks. Further, that things are likely to get difficult for France even internally due to its recent racist ban on Muslim girls wearing abaya clothing in schools. To many informed Muslims, and indeed even some non-Muslims, such racist state policies in France are nothing new. What is somewhat surprising is that by implementing the new policy, France's political elite is showing that it is in denial regarding France's economic, social, and political decline. The abaya ban is clearly a distraction aimed at diverting attention of the broader French society from real problems at home. While the Western corporate media is focused on the gimmicks of the latest racist ban, the broader picture escapes attention and thus deeper analysis. France's abaya ban is first and foremost a manifestation of France's intellectual and soft power bankruptcy. It is a sign of the total failure of its so-called secularism. Even though French secularism enjoys a monopoly of power in the media, educational and political spheres, the French state is forced to resort to Nazi-like coercive tactics to hold its intellectual and ideological ground. Contrary to France's shallow state ideology, the Muslims of France, although oppressed and at a significant disadvantage in terms of power, are able to steer political and social debates in society. This influence can in part be attributed to the exaggerations made by Emmanuel Macron's regime concerning the so-called Islamist factor. France's obsession with Muslims has inadvertently propelled them into the center stage of French politics. As a minority, it would otherwise have been busy in being integrated and earning daily sustenance, is now forced to politically mobilize and unapologetically defend itself. Macron's regime assumes that the current ban will only have impact internally. What Paris overlooks is that, unlike the earlier anti-Muslim bans in France, the world now is multipolar. This is important. Anyone who has followed, even at a superficial level, the news about France for the past year knows that the country is in deep turmoil. Macron's regime is simply opening an unnecessary social front for itself with wider ramifications. It was not necessary to open this front at a time when the West-centric global order is unraveling. Many Muslim governments in West Asia and beyond are beginning to understand that due to the new multipolar reality, they can now play big powers and not merely be played by them. The entry of Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Ethiopia and Argentina into BRICS is a sign that the master-slave relationship with Western regimes is going through reconfiguration. For cynical and Machiavellian reasons, these countries will use the Muslim factor in France to gain leverage in Europe. As was the case in Sweden, it would not be surprising if Muslim governments apply political and economic pressure on France. The days when only Western regimes could influence social currents in other countries are gone. Other countries are now gaining capabilities to reciprocate. Meanwhile, IRNA reported Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, Ensiye Khazali, has voiced deep concerns over the French government's enforcement of a law preventing Muslim girls wearing Islamic attire from entering schools. In a letter addressed to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently, Khazali called for adherence to universal standards and the utilization of all available resources to ensure individual and religious freedoms within the educational system. She said the French government's ban on wearing an abaya, a loose-fitting robe worn by many Muslim women, is a violation of fundamental human rights and the basic religious rights of the Muslim community in France. She stated, "The right to education is one of the recognized rights in international documents, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other United Nations documents and conventions, including the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and Sustainable Development Goals." The Iranian official said that the implementation of the ban on Islamic attire in France may challenge the right to education for Muslim women and girls. France passed a law in March 2004 that prohibited the wearing of religious clothing on the grounds that it constituted a display of religious affiliation in schools. Initially, this applied to headscarves, and Muslim girls were not prohibited from wearing abayas in schools. The French government announced last month it was banning the abaya in schools, the latest in a string of decisions targeting the way Muslim women dress in public.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will not tolerate the presence of terrorist groups along its common border with Iraq. Iran rejects a Western-sponsored anti-Iranian statement issued during an IAEA meeting. And a new report shows the number of Americans living in poverty has increased by 12%. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will not tolerate the presence of terrorist groups along its common border with Iraq or inside that country. Ebrahim Raisi was speaking in a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein. He stressed the necessity of full implementation of bilateral agreements on ending the presence of terrorist groups in Iraq. Raisi added that Iran did its utmost to defend Iraq when the country was under attack by the Daesh terrorist group. The top Iraqi diplomat in turn said this country is fully committed to agreements with Iran. Hussein added that the Iraqi government will never allow any group to use its soil to threaten or attack the borders of its neighbors, especially Iran. Iran and Iraq have reaffirmed their commitment to a mutual security pact aimed at eradicating terrorism from the region. In a joint press conference in Tehran, the Iranian foreign minister and his Iraqi counterpart voiced readiness to enforce that agreement. We discuss that in our news review program.
Well, it's time now for the news review of this bulletin, where we're going to discuss with our guests how Baghdad has given Tehran assurances that Iraqi soil will not be used to threaten Iran's security. Asad al-Mutalabi, Iraqi politician, joins us from Baghdad. And we have Jamal Wakim, who's a professor of international relations, joining us from Lebanese University, joining us from Beirut. All right, welcome to you both. Asad al-Mutalabi, let me first start with you. Taking a look at what these two countries have done in terms of a pact, the first question that comes to mind is, how much weight do you give this pact, though Iran and Iraq have agreed to this, in terms of the implementation, which is said to be going on right now? Are we going to see a full cleansing out of these anti-Iran operatives that can also be called terrorists against Iran?